Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Nau mai, haere mai. I'm John McDonald. Kia ora and welcome into the Community Drive Hut Zone on Thursday the 30th of October. The Hut Zone is Wellington Access Radio's weekly look into the stories, people, history, poems and music that make the Hutt Valley community. Tonight, we hear about one of the local events running as part of the current Wellington Heritage Festival, the open days at Lower Hutt's Robert Orr Historic House. And we talk to two family members about this weekend's open days and hear some of the history of Robert Orr and their family home on King's Crescent. We finish our series on Upper Hutt's industrial growth in the motor manufacturing sector, courtesy of Upper Hutt Libraries. Tonight it's about closing factories. And there's another Catherine Mansfield short story reading from her first published book, In a German Pension. Today we'll hear The Sister of the Baroness. We'll end with René Maurice's tribute song for the Pike River tragedy. So let's start things off with our weekly poetry reading. It comes from a Lower Hutt poet, Kadro Muhammad.
Kia ora and assalamu alaikum. My name is Kadro Muhammad. I'm from New Zealand and I am here to share a poem with you. Just first, I want to acknowledge the indigenous people of the land of Te Whanganui a Tara. And I'll be sharing a poem from my collection, We're All Made of Light. The poem is called A Prince Song. Whispers drowned out your morning, yesterday when you stared up at the moon. Light poured from the sky, and I drowned. Holy shit, I drowned. But I kind of liked it, because I felt like a mermaid, even though my lungs were filled with pebbles and moss. And my skin was black and blue, and my drowning kind of felt like a weird rain dance. So I drowned/danced to the chorus of a prince song. I was dead, but I was also alive. In Islam, we follow the lunar calendar. Shawl starts when the crescent moon is high in the air, like the letters Dal or Ra or Za. And when it ends, and I feel like drowning again. I came here to sing a Tina Turner song, but every time I open my mouth, lavender petals fall out. Does that mean I'm dying?
That was Lower Hutt's Kadro Muhammad reading her poem, A Prince Story. Time for our short story reading of the week, another story from Catherine Mansfield's 1911 book, In a German Pension.
The Sister of the Baroness by Catherine Mansfield, narrated by Harry Dobby.
There are two new guests arriving this afternoon, said the manager of the pension, placing a chair for me at the breakfast table. I have only received a letter acquainting me with the fact this morning. The Baroness von Gaul is sending her little daughter, the poor child is dumb, to make the cure. She is to stay with us a month, and then the Baroness herself is coming.
Baroness von Gaul, cried the Frau Doctor, coming into the room and positively scenting the name. Coming here. There was a picture of her only last week in Sport and Salon. She is a friend of the court. I have heard the Kaiserin says do to her.
But this is delightful.
I shall take my doctor's advice and spend an extra 6 weeks here. There is nothing like young society.
But the child is dumb, ventured the manager apologetically.
Bah! What does that matter? Afflicted children have such pretty ways. Each guest who came into the breakfast room was bombarded with the wonderful news. The Baroness von Gaul is sending a little daughter here. The Baroness herself is coming in a month's time. Coffee and rolls took on the nature of an orgy. We positively scintillated. Anecdotes of the highborn were poured out, sweetened and sipped. We gorged on scandals of high birth generously battered. "They are to have the room next to yours," said the manager, addressing me. "I was wondering if you would permit me to take down the portrait of the Kaiserin Elizabeth from above your bed to hang over their sofa." "Yes, indeed. Something homelike." The Frau Obereigensrat patted my hand. "And of no possible significance to you." I felt a little crushed. Not at the prospect of losing the vision of diamonds and blue velvet bust, but at the tone. Placing me outside the pale. Branding me as a foreigner. We dissipated the day in valid speculations. Decided it was too warm to walk in the afternoon. So lay down on our beds, mustering in great force for afternoon coffee. And a carriage drew up at the door. A tall young girl got out, leading a child by the hand. They entered the hall, were greeted and shown to their room. 10 minutes later, she came down with the child to sign the visitor's book. She wore a black, closely fitting dress, touched at the throat and wrists with white frilling. Her brown hair, braided, was tied with a black bow, unusually pale, with a small mole on her left cheek. "I am the Baroness von Gaul's sister," she said, trying the pen on a piece of blotting paper and smiling at us deprecatingly. Even for the most jaded of us, life holds its thrilling moments. 2 baronesses in 2 months! The manager immediately left the room to find a new nib. To my plebeian eyes, that afflicted child was singularly unattractive. She had the air of having been perpetually washed with a blue bag, and hair like grey wool, dress too in a pinafore so stiffly starched that she could only peer at us over the frill of it, a social barrier of a pinafore. And perhaps it was too much to expect a noble aunt to attend to the menial consideration of her niece's ears. But a dumb niece with unwashed ears struck me as a most depressing object. They were given places at the head of the table. For a moment we all looked at one another with an ina-dina-dina-do expression. Then the Frau Obereigensrat. "I hope you are not tired after your journey." "No," said the sister of the Baroness, smiling into her cup. "I hope the dear child is not tired," said the Frau Doctor. "Not at all."
I hope you will sleep well tonight,"
the Herr Oberlehrer said reverently.
"Yes."
The poet from Munich never took his eyes off the pair. He allowed his tie to absorb most of his coffee while he gazed at them exceedingly soulfully. "Unyoking Pegasus," thought I. "Death spasms his odes to solitude." There were possibilities in that young woman for an inspiration, not to mention a dedication. And from that moment, his suffering temperament took up its bed and walked. They retired after the meal, leaving us to discuss them at leisure.
"There is a likeness," mused the Frau Doctor. "Quite. What a manner she has. Such reserve, such a tender way with the child."
"Pity she has the child to attend to," exclaimed a student from Bonn. He had hitherto relied upon 3 scars and a ribbon to produce an effect, but the sister of a baroness demanded more than these. Absorbing days followed. Had she been 1 whit less beautifully born, we could not have endured the continual conversation about her, the songs in her praise, the detailed account of her movements. But she graciously suffered our worship, and we were more than content. The poet she took into her confidence. He carried her books when we went walking. He jumped the afflicted one on his knee, poetic license this, and one morning brought his notebook to the salon and read to us.
The sister of the Baroness has assured me she is going into a convent, he said.
That made the student from Bonn sit up.
I've written a few lines this last night from my window in the sweet night air.
Oh, your delicate chest, commented the Frau Doctor.
He fixed a stony eye on her, and she blushed.
I have written these lines. Ah, will you to a convent fly, so young, so fresh, so fair, spring like a doe upon the fields, and find your beauty there?
9 verses, equally lovely, commanded her to equally violent action. I am certain that had she followed his advice, not even the remainder of her life in a convent would have given her time to recover her breath.
I have presented her with a copy, he said, and today we are going to look for wild flowers in the wood.
The student from Bonn got up and left the room.
I begged the poet to repeat the verses once more. At the end of the 6th verse, I saw from the window the sister of the Baroness and the scarred youth disappearing through the front gate, which enabled me to thank the poet so charmingly that he offered to write me out a copy.
But we were living at too high pressure in those days. Swinging from our humble pension to the high walls of palaces, how could we help but fall? One afternoon, the Frau Doctor came upon me in the writing room and took me to her bosom.
She has been telling me all about her life, whispered the Frau Doctor. She came to my bedroom and offered to massage my arm.
You know, I am the greatest martyr to rheumatism.
And fancy now, she has already had 6 proposals of marriage. Such beautiful offers, I assure you, I wept, and every one of noble birth.
My dear, the most beautiful was in the wood.
Not that I do not think a proposal should take place in the drawing room. It is more fitting to have 4 walls, but this was a private wood. He said, the young officer, she was like a young tree whose branches had never been touched by the ruthless hand of man. Such delicacy.
She sighed and turned up her eyes.
Of course, it is difficult for you English to understand when you're always exposing your legs on cricket fields and breeding dogs in your back gardens. The pity of it. Youth should be like a wild rose. For myself, I do not understand how you women ever get married at all. She shook her head so violently that I shook mine too. And a gloom settled around my heart. It seemed we were really in a very bad way. Did the spirit of romance spread her rose wings only over aristocratic Germany? I went to my room, bound a pink scarf about my hair, and took a volume of Moric's lyrics into the garden. A great bush of purple lilac grew behind the summer house. There I sat down, finding a sad significance in the delicate suggestion of half mourning. I began to write a poem myself. They sway and languish dreamily, and we, closed pressed, are kissing there. It ended. Closed pressed did not sound at all fascinating. Savoured of wardrobes. Did my wild rose then already trail in the dust? I chewed a leaf and hugged my knees. Then, magic moment, I heard voices from the summer house, the sister of the Baroness, and the student from Bonn. Second hand was better than nothing. I pricked up my ears.
What small hands you have, said the student from Bonn. They are like white lilies lying in the pool of your black dress.
This certainly sounded the real thing. Her high-born reply was what interested me. Sympathetic murmur only.
May I hold one?
I heard 2 sighs. Presumed they held. He had rifled those dark waters of a noble blossom.
Look at my great fingers beside yours.
But they are beautifully kept, said the sister of the Baroness shyly.
The minx! Was love, then, a question of manicure? How I should adore to kiss you, murmured the student. but you know I am suffering from severe nasal catarrh, and I dare not risk giving it to you. 16 times last night did I count myself sneezing, and 3 different handkerchiefs.
I threw Marik into the lilac bush and went back into the house. A great automobile snorted at the front door. In the salon, great commotion. The Baroness was paying a surprise visit to her little daughter. Clad in a yellow Macintosh, she stood in the middle of the room questioning the manager. And every guest the pension contained was grouped about her, even the Frau Doctor, presumably examining a timetable, as near to the August skirts as possible.
"But where is my maid?"
asked the Baroness.
"There was no maid," replied the manager, "save for your gracious sister and daughter."
"Sister?" she cried sharply. "Fool, I have no sister. My child travelled with the daughter of my dressmaker."
Tableau grandissimo.
I'm John MacDonald, and you're in the Hut Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM, and that was The Sister of the Baroness by Catherine Mansfield, read by Harry Dobby. Thank you to Bookstream Audiobooks for making that reading available on your YouTube channel. Next, it's the final history episode from Upper Hutt Libraries on the city's manufacturing industries, Tales from the Trades. Tales from the Trades, from the 2024 Upper Hutt City of Industry Exhibition. End of an industrial era, the closing of factories in Upper Hutt. Featuring oral history extracts from Colin Harris, Harry Ross, Tony D, Hine Power, Marilyn Campbell, Tony and Barbara Picard.
I've got to say, when Dunlop's, you know, they closed down, Felton Textiles, V&A, General Motors, Upper Hutt died.
They did another cunning thing with redundancies. The first lot of redundancies was very cunningly done. They said, there's going to be redundancies today. Go and see your supervisor if you're on the list, right? Luckily, I had good mates up in the office said, "It's crap, Harry, there's no list." See how clever that was. So you go up to your boss here, "Am I on the list?" Yeah, if they didn't like you, I had a... They sacked themselves. And by 11 o'clock, there was about 300 or 400 guys out, gone. And by 1 o'clock, the line started up again. A few months later, they put a big notice on the board, "Overtime is coming back." Our union jumped in and said, "No, bring these people back."
Muldoon, he wanted to close the place down and we marched. I mean, a lot of Upper Hutt factories marched on Muldoon and Upper Hutt.
Well, I don't think it affected morale because, bizarrely, they had a very, very good redundancy agreement.
Yeah, yeah.
Because a lot of people, well, people who worked there would know. When they first ever, in the early 80s, they went through lean periods and they laid a few people off.
Yeah.
But what they did was, because they grossly oversubscribed to their superannuation fund and it had like $40 million too much in it.
Okay.
They went through the government actuary to get approval and the unions negotiated. And the redundancy deal, any redundancies were paid out by the super fund. Therefore, you didn't get taxed.
Right.
And because it was a superannuation payment, if you couldn't get a job, you went on the dole straight away. You didn't have to stand down because it was a superannuation payment. Mm-hmm. Oh, it was huge.
His foreman said to him the year that Dunlop's was going to close down, they were all told that Dunlop's was going to close down, so a lot of them left before the end of the year and got other tried to get other jobs, because there was a whole lot of them there. It was about 1,000 people, 1,200, in the offices as well as in the factories of that. And he said to Mike, "Mike, come back for one day next year. Don't you put in your resignation this year." And Mike said, "But it's closing." He said, "Yeah, I know, but you come back. I'm not telling anybody. I'm just telling you, and don't you tell anybody." So he did. He went back the next year, which meant he was entitled to all that redundancy. Had he left then, he would not have got any of that redundancy.
Well, one is I was looking for a wealthy person to come and buy it off me because I'd had enough after 20 years. But the main reason is the government changed the regulations and you could import product from Canada for less than what I could buy the raw materials, let alone making them.
It was the downfall of the business, really, because remember price freezes?
Yeah.
Okay, the wage price freezes. So the yarn had been sold to us at the new price, but we hadn't sold any jerseys at the new price, so we weren't allowed to put the price up from the year before.
Oh, okay.
So that was a big loss.
But we had to turn all that yarn into jerseys, or we wouldn't get anything.
That was the beginning of the end. And the second thing was that the government was giving subsidies for yarn export. So you could buy a jersey from China made out of yarn that came from wool yarns at Wingate for less than what we were paying for the yarn.
I've got to say, when Dunlop's actually closed, we went in to go to work. We knew it was going to close. We didn't know the actual date it was going to close. And I went there and the gates were closed and said, it's finished. But Dunlop's was a good place. I feel sorry that it's not here. I would love to have seen what Upper Hutt could have been.
Try to see it my way. Only time will tell if I am right or I am wrong. While you see it your way, there's a chance that we might fall apart before too long. We can work it out. We can work it out.
I'm John McDonald, and you're in the Hutt Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. And that was the last part of Upper Hutt City Library's Trade History series. The video version of the story is available by Googling Upper Hutt Recollect and Tales from the Trades. Keeping with the historic theme, we are in the middle of the annual Wellington Heritage Festival, and there is a Hutt focus of events this weekend in Petone, around the upper part of the valley, and there's one smack in the centre of Lower Hutt that caught my attention, Open Days at Robert Orr Historic House. The Italianate villa was built in 1885, and it's opening its doors and gardens to visitors on Saturday and Sunday. The homestead is still lived in by descendants of its first owner, Robert Orr. So I thought I'd contact the family and hear more.
Alexandra Orr, and I live at Robert Orr Historic Homestead. We're having an open day next weekend on Saturday and Sunday.
Hi, I'm Jude Dodds. I'm the great-granddaughter of Robert Orr.
To start with then, Alex, what will be available for viewing on the open days?
So we'll have the bottom of the house open. It's a two-story house that seen as we still live here in the house, we live upstairs, but we're keen to open the house and show everyone the rooms, the dining room, the sitting room, kitchen, and also conservatory, the garden. We have quite a lovely garden, and we also have a old workshop that's open that has a lot of old machinery and tools.
How is the downstairs of the house furnished? Are you talking original furniture and features? What can people expect to see in those rooms?
Yeah, there's quite a lot of old furniture, I guess, because it's been a family home since it was built. It has a collection of family antiques and memorabilia. So, yeah, some, particularly the dining room, the table was made by Robert Orr, so it's quite original, but there's obviously some new additions as well.
What about the garden? What's going to be available on the open days in the garden to see?
Basically, people can have a wander around. We hope it's a lovely sunny day because we're going to have some activities out for family and kids, so maybe pickleball around if they like, or just some games. Mainly just self-guided, I guess, in the house. We're here for questions, and then, yeah, people can wander out to the garden and spend as much time as they like there.
You've got an artist, I believe, working in the weekend and as part of the open days. What's involved in the artist?
Yeah, so that's Miriam Tong. She actually approached the festival organisers to see if she could get involved with the festival this year, and they put our name forward, and we're very happy that she chose us because she's going to be here for the 2 days doing a sketch of the house, and she's a fine ink pen artist and interested in heritage building. So we're very excited to see what that will turn out like, so you can people can see her in action.
The logistics then, what's the sort of the hours that you're open?
We're open 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. both days. So there is parking out on King's Crescent, and you can walk down the driveway. It's sort of tucked away, a bit hidden. And also there is parking available in All Crescent, which is around the back, and there's a little path. So we'll have a sign out for people to walk through the back if they would like to do that as well.
So what is just your street number address for people to be looking out for?
So it's 132 King's Crescent. And in the back, I think All Crescent, it's 13 All Crescent.
Things like entry fees and the like, what's involved for coming along?
So we've just put koha, whatever people feel that they're able to contribute, all of that will go into repair and restoration for the house.
Jude, if you can give us a bit of a history of the house and its origins and the like.
Right. Great-grandfather came to New Zealand with his widowed mother. They were immigrants. I think they were financed by the Presbyterian Church, actually. Yes, so he came with very little, but he was very bright, very hardworking, and through his hard work and intelligence, he was able to become the manager for one of the law firms in Wellington, which enabled him eventually to buy the land the house is on. And then later, when he had the money, he was able to build the home that's here now. He was an amazingly innovative and interesting man. His library upstairs here where we're sitting is full of books on every subject known to man, I think. He was a violinist, a horticulturalist. I mean, he was an engineer. He was a mechanic. He's got books on languages. He's got books on winemaking. I mean, this is all a long time ago. So he was way ahead of his time in lots of respects. I think he was probably a typical Scot. I think the Scots are well known for their innovative engineering and mechanical engineering skills. He imported one of the first steam cars, which is in that museum up the coast.
Southwoods?
Yes. He installed some of the very first gas lighting ever. I mean, the list goes on. He imported plants, trees, machinery for the gardens from all around the world. And all this was all through, obviously, what he was able to earn as a practice manager. I don't know what else there is to say about him. It was just pretty incredible. When you think he did as Alex said, he made the dining table. He had wood turning equipment. And honestly, there was nothing he seemed unable to put his hand to.
And you went down to Dunedin first, by the looks of things.
Yes. Well, being Scots, of course, and being
engaged.
being funded by the Presbyterian Church, obviously they landed there first. Then, yes, they came to Wellington, and I think the story is that they boarded initially with the Somerville family, which turned out to be quite fortuitous because my grandfather actually married one of the Somervilles later, many years later. So the Somerville family, I think, were quite a well-known family. Well, many of them in Wellington at the time. Yeah.
His wife, Ellen Burt, who he married in Lowart in 1886, by looks of things. Yeah. What can you tell us about Ellen?
Well, I don't know a lot about her. I know that there's some two rather beautiful pictures in the dining room with handwritten message on the back saying that they were given to her by her father, Thomas Burt, on their marriage. And I think the Burt family, there was up in Featherston, there was a little shop up there that's got a plaque on it talking about the Burts. They were quite a well-known family, and apparently the Burt sisters were all supposed to be very beautiful. We do have a portrait here of them, and they all do seem to be very attractive. I don't know. I mean, it was very hard to be attractive in those days. You didn't have makeup and
no.
to rely on natural good looks.
Yeah. He sort of added land to the house
Yes, he did. But what I point out to people when they come here, that he didn't come to New Zealand as a wealthy man, literally due to his hard work. The fact that he was obviously bright, he wasn't stupid, that he was able to do all these things. My grandfather and grandmother used to host a lot of parties. They used to have an open home pretty much every Sunday. They had the grand piano. Everybody, of course, in those days, they all sang and played. Lots of musical evenings. My grandfather used to feed everybody who turned up. He always did it. He'd put on a roast, and everybody was welcome. People would bring visitors from overseas. There were people from ballet company. There were people, musicians. There were actors. There were politicians used to visit. It was a real party house, actually, in the old days.
I've never been aware of it before. It's quite a secret, you know, historic homestead in the centre of the hut. It's quite...
Yes. Well, the thing is, of course, when it was built, it was the only house for miles around. We've got photographs of the house. You can see there's literally not another house in sight. So it went from being quite obvious to being a little hideaway. Yes. When the land around the house was sold, of course, it was built up around. When I was a child, there were open fields all around. That was in the 60s, 50s and 60s. It was still open fields. It was only later that building was done, the subdivision was done all around. And of course, there were nearly 20 acres of glass houses built at the back of the property. My great uncle, Robert, and my grandfather built, I think it was supposed to be the largest, or this is family legend perhaps, the largest amount of land under glass in the Southern Hemisphere at the time.
Right.
And it was all heated by oil. It was all oil-fired heating. So they were able to grow quite exotic. They had the first long cucumbers, the telegraph cucumbers. They grew tomatoes, which were unheard of at the time. They had to take the tomatoes and into the markets and give them away at first to because the English had no idea what a tomato was. It wasn't until the Italians arrived that people became aware of what you could do with them. They had grapes. They grew masses of grapes, and they shipped. Everything was shipped all over New Zealand by rail, taken into town, and then they sold a lot through the Thompson Brothers markets in town and Allen Street and. Yeah, Allen and the next one over.
Blair Street, is it?
Blair, that's right. Yeah, there were the big markets that were there in the old days. They used to ship a lot of their goods in there. So we've actually got some of the old weighing machines from Thompson Brothers. I collected them when the building was sold recently. One of the owners of the building, or one of the trust, the family trust, had kept these beautiful machines and didn't know what to do with them. And we've been communicating for a while. And when I said, well, you know, if you don't know what to do with them because you've sold the building, I'll take them. So I've got those at home as well now, part of the history of the house and the Thompson Brothers.
Right. And during World War II, what was its contribution to the war effort?
My father was He was at Massey doing an agricultural degree, so he was farming. I don't know what you would say. I don't know. Honestly, I don't know much about that era, but before my time, and nobody really talked about it very much. I know, apart from the fact that they grew lots and lots of food. I imagine that was it, basically.
Is there any sort of big events that stand out to you in the house's history?
Well, moving of the house. Well, 77, I think, according to my brother. I was overseas at the time, so.
What was involved in the moving? Why did that happen?
Because the piles had started to give way, all the original piles. And my father decided that rather than get under the house and try and rebuild them, he'd build a set of piles alongside the house. So they then put the house on rollers and moved it across onto the new piles. So, which was quite an extraordinary thing to do.
It is. Yeah.
There's a lot of photographic evidence. It was shambolic, obviously, if you can imagine, moving the house like that and then replanting the gardens. My mother was basically responsible for that because you've got this great big area where the house had been that had to be all replanted and turned into gardens. So she was a great one for garden. Absolutely passionate about gardening. So basically she started the modern day part of the garden.
And you've got significant trees here. I think there's a magnolia that I've seen talked about.
Yes. Yes, it's magnificent. Well, there are two, actually. There's the grandiflora and the other one, Camellia. There's a lot of beautiful old native trees as well. We've got a gigantic Niko, and we've got Riwariwa. We've got Kōwhai. Actually, Kōwhai's died right back. But what else have we got? We've got a lot of original native trees that were planted many, many years ago, as well as the magnolia. There's the old part of the garden has actually got a lot of, it's a mix of exotic and native, which is really lovely. They look good together. We've got the camellias that the Tuis absolutely adore.
They could be in flower at the moment still, are they, the camellias?
Yes, there are some in flower. Yeah.
So they should be looking good for the open day?
I hope so, yes. The wind hasn't been much fun, though. It hasn't done them much good.
No, I was going to ask how it fared during the last week's storms, did it?
Well, actually, it flattened the fence between ourselves and the neighbour, which has been a bit of a disaster. But that's life, you know, with the wind.
Yeah.
In Wellington and the heart, and all over New Zealand, have had to put up with all sorts of ghastly. I mean, that offence is nothing really compared to losing one's home. That's right.
And I suppose the fence is probably quite modern compared to a 140-year-old house there.
Yes. All the wood was brought over for the house, I think, it was brought over from the UD mill over in, I think, in the Wairarapa, as far as I know.
Right.
So lots of beautiful woods, as you've probably read.
Yeah. What are some of the challenges in owning a property that's 140 years old?
Oh, God. Where do I start? Well, for example, I mean, we've always had to do it all ourselves, my mother included. She'd been up ladders, painting. I mean, there's a 15-foot stud downstairs. She'd been up on ladders, painting ceilings. I've just last year spent a month on each of the two sitting rooms, painting them myself, taking down 20-odd pictures in each room, moving the furniture, putting it all back, rehanging the pictures. It's just one of those things we can't afford to get, I think it's better anyway. I like the idea that we can do it ourselves without bringing people from outside. I think we've managed pretty well just to do it all ourselves where we can. Obviously, the things that you have to get people in to help with. I mean, my brother had the house rewired, for example, which needed badly. Oh, that's another thing. We've still got the pipes for the gas lighting are still in the walls, apparently.
It's just in case it comes back as a trend.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have borer as a problem at all?
Not really. No, there are patches of borer, but the architect from Historic Places said that usually borer only is present when there's lots of natural gums and things still in the wood for them to devour.
Right.
And there comes a point where, when there's no more, that they give up,
right.
Apparently. But basically, it's only in very small quantities or in odd places like the old window ledge and places like that. That's really not a problem. I think these woods are so hard.
It's hard. Yeah.
Proper hardwoods, you know.
And I see that you've been working with Heritage New Zealand on a conservation plan recently.
Yes.
So what sort of things go into a conservation plan for the house?
Well, there are things that needed. In fact, we've already completed one of the things on the list. And the balconies on the front of the house, the wood had started to deteriorate and had to be replaced. So we've had that. That's already been done. The front of the house, we've also had to replace some of the wood that forms. I don't know if you know the sorts of wood on the old government buildings, parliament buildings in Wellington, with those little bits of caps of wood they put on the corners to imitate stone. A couple of those have started to come apart, and the just some things have had to be reattached, but most of that's been done. But they've also want us to paint, so that's something that's quite problematic. But the roof, of course, as well, has been a problem. It started to leak again. It was repaired probably 10 years ago, but as you can imagine, on a house this size, that far off the ground, it's going to be quite a business because there's going to be scaffolding involved, that sort of thing. So it's, not easy, and certainly not do it yourself.
And how easy is it to keep things authentic, to find things that fit? Is that a challenge as well?
We don't have to because there's too much here. we really need to get rid of things rather than... the house is chocker. I mean, when my husband and I came down here from the Wairarapa to look after my father, we had to put all our belongings in storage. There's nowhere because my great-grandparents, my grandparents and my parents, all their belongings are still here. I mean, people didn't move out. They died here. So nothing was removed when they moved on. So my great-grandfather's white tie and tails are still in one of the wardrobes. All the old great-aunt's lace is still in the drawers. There's silver and china and everything galore. I mean, we don't have to hire in anything when we have a party, that's for sure.
No.
But it's all accumulated over the years. It's not like being bought in. It's not like we've spent huge amounts of money on it. It's all been accumulated from great aunts and people leaving things to the family. In fact, we have got quite a lot of the old cooking equipment and the old kitchen implements. We've got them on show, and we intend to put more on show when we need to build more shelving so we can have those things out for people to see, like the old kitchen scales and that sort of thing. There's masses of lovely old pots and that were used on the old stove in the old days.
So it sounds like there's plenty to see during the open day.
There's a lot, yes. I think people are surprised were surprised that first year when they came here and thought they were coming to a museum because it looks like a museum downstairs, but of course it's not. It's a family home. We live here. But we're very, very happy for people to come. We want people to come. We want people to share what's here because I believe it's a really important part of the history of the district, and it should be available. We had school groups, we've had University of the Third Age, we've had old people's homes, we've had all sorts of people through, and we love having them, and we encourage it. I think it's really important because, as the historic places people said, what's really important about this house is not necessarily the house itself, it's what's in it. It's a history of generations. You can see who's added what. We haven't added anything ourselves because there's no room.
No need.
No. My mother did bring by some... Well, actually, my grandmother left my mother some beautiful furniture, which is now in the house, and some beautiful china. Yeah, so that inheritance has been a way that we've accumulated things, but certainly not going out and buying things to fit. It's unlike many historic places that have been renovated and people have gone out and bought things and bought in the appropriate pieces for the era, but there's no particular era here because it's all these generations of people.
What is your hope for the future of the homestead in 140 years' time, Jude?
Well, I'd like it still to be intact. I don't know who will be in charge of it, who will have it, who will be looking after it, but I'd like it to still be intact for future generations of local people, for local people to be able to come and share it with their grandchildren and great-grandchildren, just to show how people live. It's really interesting. My grandchildren come here. They come here a lot. They did when my parents were alive. They love bringing their friends here and showing them history. And they're 10 and 12. They've been coming since they were babies, so they're totally familiar with the house. They know their way around. And they have up to 7 or 8 children come and stay for sleepovers or campouts, and they're very much a part of the house. So that's an important part of it, the future of the house, that next generation, sixth generation of the house. So that's still there, but who knows what will come in the future. I mean, I'd like it still to be looked after by the family, but as long as somebody looks after it and keeps it intact, that's what's important to me.
Cool. That's great. Thank you very much, Jude. Yes, if you want to pass me back to Alex, and I can just finish off there. That was brilliant.
Okay, thanks, John. Bye.
Right.
Hello.
Hello, Alex. So if people want to get more information or they want to arrange a private tour in the future, and I think you do weddings and things like that, where's a good place to get information on the house?
Yes. So we're open by appointment. And since the festival last year, we got a lot of interest in afternoon teas and house tours. Yeah, as Jude said, we have had groups from several different areas come by. But if people are interested in weddings, like a small wedding or elopement, that could be something we could do. I got married here at the beginning of the year to Jude's nephew, Tom. So it was great to share the space with people and all our friends and family. So it's really like a lovely and secluded spot for something like that, or bridal shower, anything really. So we have a Facebook page, Robert Orr Historic Homestead, and Instagram, similar name, Robert Orr Historic House. And you can contact us through there or via email, which is roberthorhouse@gmail.com.
Your message then to Hut Zone Radio listeners on coming along this coming weekend to visit, what would that message, Alex, be?
We just really want to share the house and the gardens. There's people in Wellington, in the hut, wherever they're coming from. It's really special to us, and we feel lucky to live here and appreciate the garden. So we just really want to share that with everyone. So please come along.
And that was Alexandra Orr and Jude Dodds, members of the Orr family, who open the doors and historic gardens this weekend as part of the Wellington Heritage Festival. Plenty of local history on offer this weekend. But that means it's the end of this week's show. Thanks to all my guests tonight, and a big thank you to you for listening to the show and supporting Wellington Access Radio. You can always listen again to the show as a podcast on the Hut Zone pages of accessradio.org.nz. If you have a suggestion of a hut story or a piece of musical poetry, then please do message us either on Facebook, John McDonald NZ, or email the team, and our email is thehutzone@outlook.co.nz. Let's go out with former Upper Hutt-based musician Rene Maurice's tribute to the Pike River mine tragedy. Matewa. And noho oru mai rā, stay well.
All these years on, and nothing can soothe the sting. And I still wear his ring. I still cling to his life. And I was his wife. Bring our boys home. It's hard to look back, and it's not to remember a life that we lost and that life that we had. He was my dad. Bring our boys home. There was a trembling in my hand when the rocky walls began to shudder, and he was my brother. Bring our boys home. It's gone on for too long. The damage is done. He was just 21, and he was my son. Bring our boys home, just bring them out. We won't find them safe, I know. Please bring them safely home. Bring our boys home. Just bring them out. We won't find them safe, I know. But please bring them safely home.
The program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.